Okay, and welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon in America and Tuesday evening all over elsewhere in the world, and some parts even Wednesday morning. I'm Stephen Roberts. This is Cancel the Cabal on Shake and Wake Radio and EPGN Radio and PSN Radio. I had to think about there for a second, and also SoFlo Radio in Florida. Today I have a judicial whistleblower from the Minnesota area. I've learned a little bit about him, but I'm going to ask him to introduce himself, to give himself a little bit of a better bio, which is always better than me trying to read something from someone that's given me their bio. It's always better to hear it from the guest. So I do want to welcome Tom Kibler to the show. Thank you, Tom, for coming on.
You bet. Hi, all.
Thank you for contacting me, anyways.
You bet. Well, we're trying to spread the word. I'm kind of a slow learner, but it took, you know, I've been at this for fighting these guys for 11 years, and I've, for the most part, connected all the dots and realizing that there's an awful lot of fraud, and most importantly, that almost all the foreclosures that have been done are either wrongful and can be attacked for recaption, or they're absolutely void and again can be attacked for recaption.
What does recaption mean?
Recaption means peaceful taking back of something that was wrongfully taken from you.
Okay.
And there's a Prigg versus United States case that's pretty influential on that, which is actually very interesting. It was a slave owner from Pennsylvania, I believe, who had the folks in Maryland trying to take his slave away. And you know, this was back when slavery was legal. And so it went to court, and they said, well, this is his property. He gets it back. Same principle on, obviously, our property. But where I got started with this, I was in the front end. I was a marketing guy. And I worked, I got recruited for GMAC RFC, Residential Funding Corp, who was a subsidiary, obviously, of GM, GMAC. And they, in the late 90s, were primarily a securitizer of jumbo mortgages, because Fannie and Freddie, who does all the securitization, wouldn't do jumbos. And then RFC decided, hey, this new thing they're calling subprime and Alt-A looks really interesting. We should get involved with that. And they did, thinking that they'd see the same kind of CPR, constant prepayment rate, or prepayment speed, is what they call loans that pay off early. And they usually were running about 15% a year, and that's all priced in because they guarantee the cash flows on the securitizations. And so they jumped pretty aggressively into the subprime and Alt-A arena, and the things were paying off more than triple normal. They were getting 50% a year. And they tried several different ways to stem those losses and couldn't figure out a way. And so they ended up posting, and they went to the University of Minnesota and a couple other places looking for people that had an MBA and some analytical ability and whatnot. And it ended up coming down to myself and one other fellow. I got the nod, and they allowed me to hire him as my right-hand guy, which was fortunate because he in terms of mortgages, came from the industry and knew a hell of a lot more than I did. But we put together a program that was really successful, kind of a predictive model that told us when we analyzed the portfolio what people might be leaving early. And it was the first of its kind, but it really very simple. Again, if somebody had a high loan to value ratio, you know, then they're going to fall out of the Fannie and Freddie category. But if they happen to live in an area that's appreciating, property values are appreciating fast, pretty soon they're going to be back into a prime arena. Same thing with if they had a job loss and income was missing, or if they had some credit hits and they rebuilt their credit, etc. So we built a predictive model, and went to those folks preemptively and just said, hey, we value your business and we want to keep you in the portfolio. We see that, you know, whatever your situation was, it's improving. And so we want to make you an offer, you know, preemptively to improve your lot, give you a better rate or whatnot, and keep you on the books. And we hit a home run and won a couple of Minnesota Bank Marketing Association awards. What we didn't realize is that our trading desk and all the internal people on the finance side were really ticked off because they make a lot of money spinning people and churning people and, you know, redoing things rather than keeping them in there. So long story short, we got on the bad side of many of the directors and they ended up getting rid of us and we ended up getting a settlement out of them. But anyway, that was my baptism into the mortgage arena. And from there, I got involved with wholesaling with a couple other companies and with management of a small broker shop. And while I was at that shop, one of my neighbors, who was an independent broker, talked to me about a special program that Long Beach Mortgage had. And it was a program he sold me on that, because I wanted a high LTV cash out first lien mortgage, you know, 95% loan to value, but almost prime rates. And he told me that after 2 years of on-time payments, that the program would automatically drop you down into the prime area, very much like what I had done. And he knew that I had done that. It seemed great until 2 years later, after I made my payments for 2 years and was looking for the drop, and it didn't happen. And Jim had moved and closed shop. I was out of touch with him. So I contacted Long Beach, who sent me to Washington Mutual, their parent, who said, well, I'm sorry, but your buddy blew smoke. We didn't have anything like that. And so I was a little angry and pushed the issue and managed to negotiate a modification. Anyway, a point and a half drop, which was good. And then this was early 2008. When everything was falling apart and, you know, there was like an implode-a-meter website that, you know, 300, 350, 400 mortgage companies out of business. And on September 25th, Washington Mutual was seized by the FDIC as receiver. And I was contacted in October by JP Morgan Chase. Hey, we're your new lender. You know, we bought your mortgage and your loan from the FDIC. And they seemed to have all my information, so I saw no reason to not believe them.
Right.
And, I made payments for a year to them. And while I was doing it, again, rates kept dropping. And I was talking to a few different people there and said, you know, hey, you know, I would like another modification or else I'm going to refinance and and leave. And so we got to talking and they said, well, Tom, the problem is you got a high credit score here. You got a perfect payment history and, you know, we can't sell a modification, you know, to the underwriters and the people that do this. What we could do, if you're willing to stop making payments for 90 days, is show that it looks like you are in need and we should be able to sell that modification. So I said, okay. Will you put that in writing? And they said, yeah, you know, we can't, you know, I mean, what basically, you know, we're trying to help you and, you know, schmooze the underwriter. I said, okay. Well, I kind of understand that. Okay.
So what actually was your business during this time? I mean, what did you do for a living?
Oh, well, like I said, I had gotten involved in the mortgage arena at RFC, and then I was involved in wholesaling mortgages. And when this happened, I was...
It was banking then.
Yeah, I was a manager in a broker shop.
I see. Okay.
So I stopped making payments. It was October 2009. And, you know, in 90 days, I'm supposed to get a modification and everything, you know, moves on as normal. 60 days in, I get notices of intent to foreclose from Chase. And so I pick up the phone and I call my buddies. Alan Gessinger and Jose Salas, who were the guys that told me that they were helping me, and they were nowhere to be found. And no one else seemed to know anything and would talk to me about anything. So I'm a little perturbed, and I contacted the FDIC. And I said, hey, you guys, peddled my mortgage supposedly to Chase, and I'm having an issue with them. And they said, well, we need to stop you right there. We don't have any evidence that we conveyed any mortgage or anything to Chase. We were the receiver, but we don't have any documentation of any mortgages. Kind of set me off and got me into diving deep and doing a lot of research and following people like Bill Padelow at his BP Investigative Agency.com and Neil Garfield at livinglies.me and a lot of these folks who it's become common knowledge now, which ticks a lot of us off, and it should, that Chase acquired certain assets of Washington Mutual. None of the mortgages the Washington Mutual had originated and or sold, a lot of off the hedge funds and whatnot. But the FDIC, knowing that this was just a big mess, kind of, gave a wink and nod agreement to Chase that, hey, you can claim that you're the servicer and you can do, whatever you want with these people. And Chase said, well, servicing people and collecting payments over 30 years is a nice cash flow, but it's a lot more lucrative if we could just steal these homes. So
it is.
They did.
It is.
I came to find out the 90-day thing. Day 91 is a big ka-ching. Dave Krieger at cloudedtitles.com and on his blog did a big article about a month ago on this. And on day 91, they're filing all kinds of insurance claims, mortgage insurance and default insurance and credit default swaps, and collecting as much as 12 to 14 times the face value of the note.
Yes, yes.
So they're hugely intrigued, or I should say incentivized, to lie to you and throw you into default, and I'm stealing your property. The only reason they do that is to cover up the trail.
Well,
they're making a lot more.
I've also seen somewhere, maybe in an article or something, that once you have applied for a home equity loan, they automatically start the procedures for a foreclosure.
Yeah, I think for the most part, it's coming out. Actually, Neil Garfield has been writing a lot about this in the last couple of weeks because he's got a big seminar for lawyers on Wednesday about challenging these fake assignments and whatnot. And it's coming out that none of these securitizations were legitimate. And most of these REMIC trusts, real estate mortgage, investment conduits, REMIC trusts, most of them are just shells. They never securitized anything, and they really didn't make loans to us. They paid us for our signature and made it look like a loan so that they could turn around and make 10 times on the front end and 12 to 14 times on the back end, but really they securitized our information, and they it's identity theft because they're trafficking our person, if you will, our two-dimensional identity, our signature, and our
fictional straw man. Yeah.
And it's coming to light finally, but it's been a tremendous scam. And when I again first started digging and found out that Chase had absolutely lied to me, I did a little digging, and I uncovered that we've got rights under the Uniform Commercial Code, UCC 3501. Says, hey, we can demand proof that we owe somebody, that they've got an interest, and they need to prove up, or we can ignore any of their demands and their threats. And 9203 says that they've got to prove that they paid a value or an to acquire the interest in the mortgage or loan or note. And so I started making demands to Chase, and they ignored me and hid from me. And finally, After the national mortgage settlement and a couple other consent agreements, you know, the OCC in the news looked like they were after Chase. They really didn't do anything, you know, other than, you know, collect a little bit of money. But, you know, again, you know, if you're stealing $1 billion and you get fined $1 million, that's not too much incentive for you to stop.
Right.
And, you know, that's exactly what was going on. So I got a notice in the mail from Chase saying that they were assigning interest in my mortgage. And shortly after that, they said that they had, you know, changed servicing. And suddenly I was dealing with this select portfolio servicing down in Salt Lake City, Utah. The former Fairbanks Capital, who got shut down by the FTC and HUD for deceptive and dishonest practices. And so, of course, they wrote a check and changed their name. Not much else changed. And now they're my servicer. And I started demanding, again, some paperwork. Hey, Chase has never proved to me that I owe them anything, that they have any interest in my property. And by the way, I hadn't, you know, I still have not made a payment to this day since October 2009, because nobody proved anything. And it seems that they made a lot of money off me and, you know, damaged my credit. Of course, you know, locked things up in the land records, slandered my title. I haven't been able to do anything, but I kept, like I said, digging and researching. And so I got a hold of the actual assignment from October 2012, where they said that they were assigning interest in my mortgage to Deutsche Bank National Trust Company, another very checkered history company, JPMorgan Chase, Deutsche Bank, and Credit Suisse, the owner of Select Portfolio Servicing, are, if my memory is right, number 2, number 7, and number 12 on the top 100 list of most penalized companies, violation on violationtracker.com. About 64, 65 billion between the three of them. So not choir boys by any means. But I got a hold of this assignment. And again, it's October 2012, and I'm reading through it. And because I came from the business, I, you know, I knew a little bit. And when it said that it was assigning interest to a REMIC trust, Long Beach Mortgage Loan Trust 2005 dash WL2, that jumped out at me right away, because I, you know, I said, well, a 2005 trust. I went to the SEC and looked some information up and went, well, they closed August 30th of 2005. And gee, I'm looking further here. And they, you know, and then they filed a suspension, a 15D is what it's called, January 2006. I don't even know if they exist, but I know that by the terms of the REMIC agreement, it's pooling and servicing agreement, basically it's indenture, and by the New York laws, it's closed. That closing date of 2005, it is closed. 7 years later, there's no way anything could be assigned to it, especially something that would be labeled a non-performing loan, you know, because it had been getting payments. So then I really started pitching a fit to all the authorities and getting absolutely nowhere. The CFPB, what's Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, and I think they might have changed their name a little bit now, but I sent them dozens of complaints, and every one of them, they took the complaint and they sent, you know, if it was about Chase or if it was about Deutsche or if it was about SPS, they'd send it to them, that company, and then that company would write back and say, oh, Tom's mistaken, you know, we're lily white, you know, we're perfect, and you know, we didn't do anything wrong. And the CFPB would write back to me and say, we did our investigation and we found out that, you know, these people are lily white and perfect and did nothing wrong. So we're gonna close our file, but if we can do anything else for you ever, let us know. This is still going on. I'm not the only person with this experience. I think that's pretty much
Yeah.
the rule.
I've got a friend in Ireland. I think he pretty much did the same thing that you did. Found out the same information, and he just well he took the stick and rattled the hornet's nest. Actually, twice he wrote to the bank that had his mortgage, or I'm sorry, the bank that illegally bought his first mortgage, and he also called them, and he thanked them personally for paying his loan off, paying his mortgage loan off. Thanked them personally, and he hasn't paid since.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. When they do these mortgage assignments, and they send that to people, here, we assigned your mortgage. And most of us, including me, until I saw the variance with the dates, thought, well, okay, they assigned my mortgage. An assignment of a mortgage is supposed to just memorialize the proper sale, negotiation, conveyance, transfer, and delivery of the note. The mortgage is just security to the note. If they don't have anything to do with the note, the mortgage is just a piece of toilet paper.
Sure. What could you explain to the listeners what the MERS and the LIBOR scandal is? How would you explain it to someone?
Oh, well, MERS, for all practical purposes, is just a database. It's not even a company, although it's set up as one. And very interesting. There's a woman named Renee Weiler who's in Michigan, who does the Weiler audits. I'm getting off track here, but I'll circle back. But she has found very interestingly that on a lot of politicians, a lot of judges, she'll do a MERS audit on their property, and she'll see that there are like 20 or more mortgages on their property. A lot of them show, taken out in January and paid off in April. Well, gee, how does this happen? Except, well, maybe this is a good way to do bribery and money laundering. Because it's just a little electronic database that shows the mortgage status.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, but the fiat banking system is you put $1 into their bank and they can loan out $9. Correct?
Yeah.
Is that the same with a mortgage? They can loan to another bank or another institution $9 to one if they sell your mortgage?
Seems that way. And actually, again, Neil Garfield has pretty much said, even though we don't think there's really a mortgage anymore. There used to be back in the old days, but in the advent of the securitization and MERS, there's the illusion of a mortgage. And basically, they're taking your loan application and taking that to the Fed window and getting some money. And again, putting that in as a deposit, and they're able to loan that out multiple times, as you said. They also, in other areas of the scam, according to Neil, they make about 11 times the face amount of your note when they go through the process of what looks like an origination and a securitization, but really isn't. A lot of hedge funds and off-balance sheet shenanigans going on. And then, as Dave Krieger pointed out, on the default end, and the way that they manufacture these things, we're in default pretty much from day one because they set this up as a scam. So, they're just looking for the opportunity to declare a formal default, at which time they're getting 12 to 14 times on the back end. So you're pretty much talking at what, 25 to 30 times the amount of your note that they're making off of you. And Neil Garfield is really trying to push for a national movement to say, hey, we figured out the scam. I thought I took out a $300,000 loan. In effect, you made $8 or $9 million off my signature, and you paid me 300 grand for the signature. It really wasn't a loan, and I deserve a bigger cut of that. That was a lot of unjust enrichment and a lot of fraud, a lot of non-disclosure. And it's going to be interesting to see, where this goes. But circling back to MERS actually, like I said, it just became a database. And, think of it like a like a stock exchange for mortgages, so that they could just transfer much easier. I got lucky because my loan was not with MERS. At the time, about half were and half weren't. But interestingly, when I looked at my fake assignment, it had a MERS written on it. It had a MERS telephone number. It also had Carrington Mortgage Services and a Carrington Mortgage Services account, yet they were assigning it to Select Portfolio Servicing. And of course, this whole thing was created by one of the foreclosure mills here in town. And one of the foreclosure mill shysters is the guy that recorded it in the land records, which again is, a couple of felonies right there, criminal forgery, creating an assignment that was not a valid assignment and recording it, false recording in the land records. And then they go on, of course, with, fictitious accounts and false claims and counterfeiting the note, laundry list of felonies. And this is interesting because I mentioned that, I sent out some affidavits to a lot of the politicians and folks that didn't follow their oaths of office to protect, my property and my security when I went to them. And I also sent one to the foreclosure mill, shyster lawyer. And it basically is structured that, you need to rebut all these 11 or 12 points, or you're admitting to them. And if you don't rebut, you're also admitting to this laundry list of crimes. And it's a bunch of federal codes, a bunch of state statutes, and a bunch of common law crimes, probably 50 of them. And again, I gave him 30 days. He got that last week. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. But going back to MERS, they, in a lot of states, basically got tossed out, because realized, hey, this MERS exchange, it says on this piece of paper that they assigned my Wells Fargo note or my Citibank note and mortgage.
It's funny you mentioned Wells Fargo. It's funny you mentioned Wells Fargo because I have a question about them.
I spent several years off and on with them.
They have completely left at least three states that I know of. They have left Indiana, they have left Michigan, and they have left Ohio. Not one single bank in either of those three states. Have any clue what could have happened? Or have you heard anything about what might have happened?
I haven't. But I think, again, it's speculation on my part. I think a lot of what's going on is that these banks have been in bed with our state attorney generals since the national mortgage settlement. They made a big announcement. Hey, $25 billion.
And also the drug cartels, too.
Yeah.
Wells Fargo is one of many, many banks that have been caught several times laundering drug cartel money through their banks.
Oh, absolutely. I think all the big ones have been caught red-handed again. And you made $1 billion doing this. That was bad.
Yeah, we're going to find you $100 million.
Fine.
Yeah, and we're going to find you $100 million.
Yeah.
That's like taking two quarters out of your pocket. If you got $1,000 in your pocket, taking out two quarters. Yeah.
Exactly. It's just crazy. But my mortgage assignment that I was talking about, my mortgage assignment, it's a forged document. But as I looked at it further, I saw that it was signed by a guy with a fairly uncommon name, as a vice president of Chase. And, so I contacted Chase trying to run this guy down. Nobody knew who he was, and people said they didn't, hadn't never heard of him. And I thought they were just covering things up. But I kept, for years, I Googled the guy and I found, I found about 20 people of the same name and contacted almost all of them. And, finally, one day I hit the right guy. He said, yeah, that's me. And I said, well, the reason I'm calling you is because I've got this document you know, it purports to have your signature on it. And I'm concerned. I'm finding out in a lot of these scams that, you know, they've stolen people's signatures, you know, made stamps of them, you know, and they're documents.
Or they paid them $20 an hour to go into a room and sign their name. Correct?
Exactly. There you go. This is where we're going. So I'm talking to this guy. You know, he said, you know, I was a seasonal temp clerk in the end of 2012, beginning 2013 at Chase in their Ohio mortgage office. And, you know, he said that, you know, I mean, I was one of those guys that, you know, signed documents. And I said, well, you want to take a look at this? Tell me,
They were bare documents, though, weren't they? They didn't have nothing on them. He just signed his name. And then they printed what they want on afterwards, is what I believe, yeah.
Well, what he told me is that he needed to line up. He needed to make sure that the document had my name, the note information, and my address. And then he signed off, you know, as a vice president of Chase, which, of course, he wasn't. He was a MERS-approved signer.
Right.
You know, most of these things were MERS. But, you know, as I questioned him, you know, he said, yeah, you know, I'd sign, you know, 400 or 500 documents a day. I never saw a collateral file. I never inspected it. I never knew what, you know, what these were referring to at all. And I said, you know, were you sitting right there with a notary, you know, that notarized your signature? Nah, they were, you know, in another building.
No, because they paid somebody else $20 an hour to do that.
Exactly. So, I managed to get an affidavit from this guy. And, you know, he basically said, I was a temp clerk. I was never a vice president. I had no authority. I had no personal knowledge. I signed these things. And I didn't pay any attention until Tom contacted me and basically educated me on the fact that it's now been proven that Chase is out there lying. You know, they never, you know, became successor in interest to Washington Mutual. They never purchased these mortgages. You know, so I'm just saying, hey, that's my signature. I signed it. It's a fraudulent document, and I'll attest to that, you know, because I was fraudulently induced. And once I got that document, I thought, hey, I solved my case. I got no problems anymore, because I've kind of skimmed over. Minnesota is a non-judicial state. So, you know, all they have to do is basically send a foreclosure notice and say, we're going to advertise a foreclosure sale and we're going to foreclose on you. And just because I had enough questions and questionable documents and made a stink, I kept challenging them, but I went through 11 or 12 non-judicial foreclosure attempts and sheriff sales, you know, and I would go attend the sheriff sale, you know, with my little flyer saying, hey, this is all fraud, and anybody that wants to make a bid, you know, all you're doing is jumping into some litigation, etc. I got them all canceled, to the point that they sued me judicially, you know, so we could go before a judge to have it decided. And this is when I had, you know, found my robo-signer and got that document. And I thought, well, this will put it to bed. And it didn't. They ignored that document. I filed a motion to dismiss for absolutely lack of standing to sue, no financial interest. They ignored that. The foreclosure mill shyster brought a forged note that had a signature on the back of it, an endorsement by a guy, Jess Almanza. It's pretty well known. There's an article MFI Miami wrote saying that about 16 or 17, I think they busted Chase on a Cynthia Riley. They found out that they had taken a Cynthia Riley rubber stamp of a signature and started applying it to the back of all these fake notes that, you know, I mean, they did acquire from Washington Mutual and Long Beach all the electronic information. So they'd print off these notes and they'd stamp this fake signature endorsement on there, and they would foreclose and steal. And a lawyer tracked down Cynthia Riley and got a deposition from her. And that kind of put the kibosh on them using her name. So they dug through the old, you know, shelves and files and drawers and they pulled out the name of Jess Almanzar. And Jess had been a vice president at Washington Mutual, or at, Washington Mutual. And they started applying his signature as a signatory or an endorser on all these Long Beach mortgage notes that they hadn't gotten around to with Cynthia Riley. And a few people have tracked Jess down, and Jess has stated in a declaration, and I believe a deposition as well, I never worked for them, and I never endorsed a single note. So again, I thought that was pretty important in my case, but my judge refused to allow us to inspect the note. You know, we'd already.
Do you know why that was?
I'm sorry?
Do you know why none of this worked? It was all ignored because it's a kangaroo court. It's not a real court.
Exactly. Yeah, it's an administrative tribunal.
Yes.
Which we didn't know at the time. But yeah, it's just a private court where if we're knowledgeable enough, I'm finding out now. I haven't proven it, but it's my theory, since all our constitutions say that we should get due process, and my Minnesota state constitution, which starts out saying government, is only instituted for the benefit and protection and security of the people who have all the power and who can get rid of all the politicians and public servants at any time if they're unhappy with the way they're doing things. We've got the right to due process. We can never be deprived of any property or rights without years, which would be a trial by jury, or the law of the land, which would be common law.
Yeah.
And of course,
if people keep accepting this system, we don't actually have any rights if we keep accepting this system. It is a fraudulent system, and they make their own rules up. If you accept being their fictional straw man, you don't have any rights. None of us do.
The only rights we have are the rights that we demand, and most of us are ignorant at this point.
Sure, sure. There is actually only one law. I keep telling everybody there is only one law. It's do no harm. Whether it's physical harm, emotional harm, social harm, harming your neighbor by destroying his property or his dwelling or whatever he happens to own,
And in the common law perspective, anytime any harm or injury that you do to someone, it's called a trespass, and so you make amends.
Yes.
Very simple system. Do no harm. If you do harm, make amends.
That's right. That's right.
And as far as these people trying to foreclose with forged documents and getting away with it, the Constitution was very clear. The Supreme Court is very clear on the constitutional irreducible standards to determine standing to sue in a lawsuit is that, number one, there's got to be a concrete injury in fact claimed. And, of course, they need to be able to prove that as well. They also need to claim and prove that the injury was caused by some action on my part, if I'm the person being sued, and that a favorable decision would redress that injury. So, for example, to put it in more straightforward terms, there's got to be someone saying, a man or a woman saying that they were harmed or injured by the breach of either a contractual agreement or a law, and that they can be redressed with a favorable decision.
Or a fraud, yeah.
Yeah. Tom signed this agreement. He was going to make payments to me. He stopped making payments, and now I've been injured. If you got a legitimate claim, okay, then the court should try and redress that.
That's right. That's right. There's a Canadian show host. He's on a different network. He's explained on the show a few times that he was ticketed for whatever reason it was. I don't remember what the reason was now. He was ticketed and fined, and he actually went after he received, went to the, well, it would be the RCMP up there in Canada. He explained to him, you know, you've harmed me. You have claimed to have, taken an oath not to harm somebody, but you've harmed me here. Yep. And he explained to him, the ticket was torn up and wasn't any court.
That's how it should work. I don't know if you're talking about Christopher James. If not, Christopher James as well.
No,
that's not him. AppealsCalls.com is, he's pushing the common law, and given the court's fits up there.
Well, I don't actually know anything about common law, and I don't think my friend does either. I mean, you don't really have to know anything about common law to know what's the difference between right and wrong.
Exactly. It's very basic. And the way it's been explained to me, which I find fascinating and infuriating at the same time, is that, you know, again, we've got a common law system, which is do no harm. If you do harm, you know, then make amends. Very simple, very easy. And the Bar Association, the lawyers, have taken over. Basically, they put an overlay of the on our underlying very basic foundation of a good law system, like we were just talking about. They put this legal system with all these statutes and codes and rules and regulations, all this legal crap and rules of civil procedure. And, you know, and you hear people say, you know, I went to court, you know, and, you know, they got me on some procedural crap. Again, that's because they sucked us into their fake court, this administrative tribunal, where they're following these legal rules and the rules of civil procedure. And we're going in thinking that we've got our constitutional, well, our God-given rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution. And we're right. We've got the facts. You know, I grew up watching Nation and Jeff the Defense. You know, and if you're right, you win.
Sure. Now, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights here in America don't give us anything. Not one single thing. Unless you can actually get a hold of those documents and sign your name on them. Then you would be legally bound to them.
Yeah, there's people like Carl Miller and a friend of mine, Charlie Sewell, and a few other people that have been pretty successful. You know, as I described a little bit with the affidavits that I sent, if you get a copy of the oath and you accept the oath and you file it into the county records, you're into the case, then just by having that in there, it's referring to the state constitution and the federal constitution. So when you're claiming those rights and demanding them, I don't know that anything's ever been decided in court yet. If you get that far, you end up things getting dismissed or settled, I believe.
Or killed.
Yes, and that happens. Actually, a good friend of mine who beat PHH Mortgage and was a brilliant guy, a legitimate, you know, Mensa engineer, or retired engineer, but legitimate Mensa member. He started helping a bunch of other people on their foreclosures because, you know, he was fascinated and ticked off by the whole thing. And he was intrigued by, I think it was Lynn Simoniak, you know, who got the, she's one who was on 60 Minutes. She filed a big QI-TAM action and, with the government as a co-plaintiff. And I think they got like 80 million and, you know, her share was like 18. And so anyway, my friend Dave said, I'm filing a bunch of these QI-TAMs, and he helped a bunch of people. And my friends in Salt Lake City, Select Portfolio Servicing, kept sending, attorneys and attorney generals after Dave saying he was practicing law without a license, you know, and he just laughed and say, you know, I'm not practicing. I'm pretty good at what I'm doing.
Yeah,
I'm not
that's right. Money.
You know, so go away.
You need a license if you're going to practice. It is illegal to practice law. That's why you need a license.
Well, it's illegal, but it's not unlawful.
That's right.
Carl Miller, that I talked about, used to go to court all the time, and again, that was his argument. And you know, he got away with it because he knew his common law and he knew his Supreme Court history so well.
I think Carl Lentz does the same thing.
Yeah, very similar. You know, I'm far from an expert. Like I said, you know, I've been digging into this 11 years, and I'm only recently, you know, connecting these dots. But, you know, what we are connecting, we're finding out that this is, you know, tremendous fraud. And I had trouble understanding that, you know, even until like a year ago. I was going to be the guy that was going to educate these poor, confused judges on what they're missing, you know, so that we could fix this. And
now, you know,
they're not confused. They're in on it.
Somebody really wants to try to grasp the magnitude of this. There are currently 460,000 laws on the American books. 460,000 laws. You cannot do anything without breaking the law. And, you know, the quotations.
Most of those are classified as statutes and codes and rules.
Sure.
And regulations.
Absolutely. And if you look in their Black Laws Dictionary, that's what they say. Their Black Laws Dictionary, they say laws, look under corporate statutes, corporate rules, corporate regulations, corporate administrative laws. That's what they say.
You're exactly right. And again, that's where they get us. You know, they got us playing this legal game, and we should, as you were talking, we should just be playing the law game. Well, if I did something wrong, I'll make amends. Otherwise, go away. You know, if there's not an injured party, then there's really no reason for the courts to ever be involved. And wonderful case, Marbury versus Madison. It's over 100 years old. It says that.
Well, it's like 170 years old, isn't it?
Yeah, it's way back there.
Yeah.
Well into the 1800s. But it's, you know, any statute, code, rule, regulation, mandate, whatever, that is repugnant to the Constitution,
yep,
is void. Doesn't need to be paid attention to at all. It's invalid. You know, anyone tries to enforce it, it's just junk.
Well, did you know?
Know that and claim those rights. Otherwise, you know, to this day, you know, we're still every day getting ticketed and all these other things that are unconstitutional and paying them because we don't know.
I'll give you a mind blower here. We've got about 9-10 minutes left, and I'll let you explain some more things that you want to finish out with. But it is totally against federal laws to knowingly and willingly participate in a fraud. And the toxic debt is believed to be about $2.5 quadrillion worldwide.
Oh yeah,
about 900 billion here in America. Or, I'm sorry, 900 trillion here in America. You know, people keep talking about this American debt at, I don't know what it's currently supposed to be at, like, what is it, 30 trillion or 40 trillion or something like that, but it's actually tons closer to 900 trillion.
It's amazing, and that's why we're dealing with so much corruption, because there's so much fake fiat currency, you know, credits to be bribed, to be given to people so that they'll, you know, turn a blind eye to things. And it's insane. I've determined, which again, why I'm trying to handle my stuff outside of court right now. They've scheduled, by the way, my sheriff's sale number 15 on October 28th. You know, and if I fail to get it canceled, either way, I'm showing up at the sheriff's office.
Well, that's just an offer to contract with them.
Exactly. You know, and the sheriff seems to be digging in hard, because I went to the OCC, I went to the FTC, the FDIC, the SEC, the IRS, the Secret Service, the FBI, and I got nowhere. And I actually met with the FBI personally and gave them a bunch of documentation, which they really didn't want. And when we were done, they said, you know,
well, you're to put it in a metaphor, you're trying to speak Japanese to a guy that's to an Italian man. That's what you're trying to explain stuff to them.
Well, and I'm also trying to complain to the, you know, the fox about, you know, the eggs.
Yes. In the hen house. The fox breaking into the hen house. Yes. Yes.
So, you know, the FBI did, they said, look, you know, you've done your homework and you got all these documents. So, you know, we can't say you're full of crap, but we can say that we can't do anything with this. It sounds like something local.
Because we don't know what to do.
Right. And property, you know, property concerns usually are, you know, by the state or the county or city, you know, they're considered local unless there's something federal that overrides it. So, you know, they said, we recommend you take it to the police, file a police report, you know, and see if you can get it enforced locally. So I filed a police report. I went to the sheriff. I went to the county attorney. We don't have a DA. We have a county attorney. I went to the county manager, the county commissioner, the attorney general, and got nowhere. I actually have copies of my police report. And, you know, I gave him copies of, you know, forged documents. That's a felony. Filed into the land records. That's a felony. Making a false claim. Another felony. Of a fictitious obligation. Another felony. Using counterfeit documents, another felony, the list of felonies. And they said, yeah, we consider this a civil matter, which should be handled in civil courts by our bought and paid for or threatened judges. So that's, again, I've got all that paperwork. So that's where I'm trying to box them in outside of court and say, because you didn't do what you're supposed to, you violated my rights. You know, at 18, USC 241 and 242, you know, violation of rights and conspiracy, and 42 USC 1983, 1985, and 1986, which is the civil side of the same thing, plus failure to prevent or protect, which again, when you go to these people, here's a wonderful thing to write down and to Google because you'll come up with some very interesting stuff. 63C, like Charlie, AmJur, short for American Jurisprudence, 2D, like David. And basically that says that all public servants, people that are elected and or working, you know, in the agencies, you know, and anybody that's in that place of a trustee relationship, they're trustees to the people and they have fiduciary duties and obligations. And if they shirk those, they can be found liable. So when we go to these people and they say, oh, I've got discretion to just blow you off and I am not going to do anything, you know, most of us have just walked away and went, well, that sucks. And I did that too until I kept digging and I found out, hey, wait a minute. And I started calling them on this and on the, you know, 18 and 42 codes. All of a sudden, they won't talk to me. I've got a clerk that I used to email all the time. And we'd butt heads a little bit, but we developed a, you know, a little bit of a rapport. And, you know, he was always giving me crap when I had my attorneys about, you know, rules of civil procedure where we can't do this. And at one point, after I got past this and after I fired my three attorneys that I found out were trying to throw me under the bus, I said, wait a minute. I got to ask, is there any evidence that these rules of civil procedure apply to me personally, Tom, the man? Not the person that was being represented by my legal representatives. And he basically was speechless, won't return my emails, won't return my calls anymore, which is the argument that Alphonse Fajola and Christopher James up in Canada are making that, look, your rules of civil procedure, that's your legal world. Let's go back to the real world. Law, man, woman. Is there a man or woman that IDM injured or damaged? And then if there is, let them make a proper claim and we'll make amends. If there's not, then this whole thing is an illusion. You know, it's basically theater. And we're not in a real court. We're in your corporate court. It's fixed. And if we know enough to stand up to it, like Christopher James is giving him fits. Alphonse is over in Pennsylvania, and they actually started shutting the courts down on days when he was scheduled to come. They'd say, oh, we've got a, you know, the big COVID concern today. The whole courthouse is shut down. And an insider from the courts actually got on, I think it was Crow 777's radio show, and said, I wanted to call and talk about Alphonse because I'm, you know, I'm on the inside. They've been having meetings, and they said, you know, he's given us fits, but our big concern is, you know, if we get it, you know, we can handle one of him in the state, you know, by shutting down the court and stuff and, you know, messing with them. But if there's, become more, two or three or a handful of Alphonses, that's trouble. This is scaring us. And, if there's that concern in one state from one person, again, the more of us that realize, hey, this crap you're doing doesn't apply to me unless you can prove it. Which again, on these foreclosures, it doesn't matter that I signed a note and agreed to make payments to Long Beach if Long Beach is gone. What matters is who is saying that I owe them now, and can they document that they've got a right to make demands and that we have an agreement that I breached? And if they don't, they need to pound sand. And I'm afraid that we've got a lot more, again, all these people that have been on the, payment moratoriums and whatnot. It's a scheme and a scam, and they're going to steal homes very aggressively. But if you write to them and demand, make a qualified written request, and you can look at 15 USC 1692, and it talks about, debtor rights on asking for this confirmation and information, as well as the UCC 3501, say, I need proof that whoever you say, my payments are supposed to go to, we've got servicers involved and we've got trustees, and maybe there's a REMIC trust or some other bank. I need proof, again, UCC 9203, that they paid good money to acquire that and that I actually owe them. I need a copy of the note and the mortgage in their current condition, and I need a copy of the complete accounting and payment history. UCC 9210 says you can demand all the accounting. And most of the time, there is no proper accounting. You're not on a proper ledger
No.
as a receivable and an asset like you're supposed to be because of the scheme and
Because it's
scam.
all fraudulent, yeah.
Right. But most of us have, we haven't known. And I've got friends that, they're starting to ask questions, are
Sure.
you saying that I've been making payments for 25 years and I never needed to?
Yep.
Well, kind of.
I can't give you financial advice, but yeah. Well, I think this is we're at the hour here, Tom. So I think we've had a pretty good show. I mean, if you have more, we could go on more.
I mean, that's most of what I have. Like I said, we just got to the point now where I've got all the people that I talked about, that authorities, our public servants. I guess that's a point I really want to make, that none of these authorities are authorities. They're public servants. They work for
That's
us.
right. That's
If we're
right.
not happy with what they do, then we need to correct them and admonish them and replace them if they can't do the job. But we'll see what happens here. I got all 13 of my green cards back on Friday and Saturday from the affidavits I sent out last week. I gave those 11 days to rebut. And I don't think anybody will rebut because, again, it's under penalty of perjury. And we'll be catching them lying. I mentioned Pablo and his BPinvestigativeAgency.com. If you look on there, September 23rd and May 14th of last year, and a few others. He is busting JPMorgan Chase in public, proving that they have lied,
Yeah.
using their own wording
Well,
and rules and regulations and writings of the SEC, the FDIC.
it's easier to pay somebody like you off than to try to fight it in court. A lot cheaper too, because they can just go on to some other schmuck and scam them.
Yeah, well, as you said, and I guess I got off track. I failed to finish my point about Dave McRae. After all the threats and whatnot, and Dave, they probably offered him money. I don't know. I mean, I talked with Dave, quite frequently, and I know that they threatened him. We didn't never got any further. But one weekend, while his family was out of town, he mysteriously died.
Yeah.
And it's
Yeah.
been 2 years, no autopsy results yet.
Yep. And there won't be any. Won't be any either. So thanks again, Tom.
You bet. Thank you, Steve.
All right. I know we'll talk soon.
Okay, take care.